Another activity is to explore non-classical phenomena. So the idea there is you look at something that quantum theory predicts will happen in an experiment, and many of these things seem unintuitive by the lights of a classical worldview. And so people try to find more of these things. So examples here would be Bell's theorem, for example, which shows that there's a sense in which quantum theory is non-local, or interference phenomena, or you know, more exotic things like the quantum Zeno paradox, if you've ever heard of that, or quantum teleportation. So there's lots of these things, and a lot of people in foundations think hard about new, strange phenomena that we don't see classically. And then finally, a third activity, which has got a lot of steam these days, is to try to find some conceptual principles, some foundational principles, from which you might derive the mathematical formalism of quantum mechanics. So to explain what I mean by that, compare to what happens for special relativity. So in 1905, we already had the Lorentz transformations. And what Einstein did was to show that those mathematical formulas followed from a couple of physical principles, namely the relativity postulate and the postulate that the speed of light is independent of the speed of the source. And the idea is that you learn something when you do that, because arguably you'd be hard-pressed to derive general relativity if you didn't really understand what the content of the Lorentz transformations were. So you could say this was an important step towards developing a theory of gravity for Einstein. So you might think that it would be reasonable to think about quantum theory in a similar way. So we have the mathematical formalism of quantum theory. I'll be talking more about that later in the lecture. And the idea is that maybe we can find some set of physical principles that are, you know, the physical principles will be to the mathematical formalism a bit what these principles are to the Lorentz transformations. More of the flavor of a statement about the way the world is rather than some abstract mathematical formulas. So that's the idea of that third activity. And I should say that they're not independent, these activities. So for example, a lot of the ideas for what might constitute a useful principle come from this category here. So people find phenomena that appear to be non-classical, and many of those are a good starting point for trying to say what's innovative about quantum theory relative to a classical theory. So as one example, which doesn't work, I'll tell you right now, people ask themselves whether if you took non-locality in Bell's sense, so violations of Bell inequalities, together with the fact that you can't signal faster than the speed of light, might it be that that implies the mathematical formalism of quantum theory? Could it be that quantum theory is the only theory that has those two features? Turns out it's not. There are other theories that have those two features. But nonetheless, I mean, that's the sort of spirit of these sorts of approaches. Try to figure out precisely what it is about quantum theory that's different from other theories. And at the end of the day, what you'd really like to have is a set of logically independent fundamental axioms. And then with that, you could do something like you know, maybe change one of the axioms, get a different theory from quantum theory, maybe move beyond quantum theory. And finally, there's a lot of people who believe that if you've done this, if you've got some simple axiomatization of quantum theory, then that will help you figure out what a good interpretation of the formalism might be. So in this course, we're going to spend a fair bit of time on sort of setting the background framework for this sort of activity, and I'll be talking a little bit about axiomatization. I'm going to talk about Bell's theorem and the Cochen Specker theorem, which fall into this sort of category. There's sort of prominent results about what's different about a quantum world. And then in the final week, I'm going to survey a number of different interpretations that people have suggested for the formalism. Okay, so let me pause there for questions. So everybody's happy with big picture? Good. Okay, this lecture then I'm going to ask the question, you know, why is there any debate at all about the interpretation of quantum theory? You know, we've all seen that textbook approach to quantum theory. So you might say, well, what's wrong with that? You know, why do we need anything besides what we learn in the textbooks? So let me start with those textbook axioms. So this is, I'm not thinking of any particular textbook, but I'm trying to sort of distill out from a number of different sources what we generally learn is the basis of quantum theory. And I'm going to call them the orthodox postulates. And I'm going to call the interpretation that goes along with these textbook postulates just the orthodox interpretation, the standard one. I mean, there's a lot of debate over what's the standard interpretation. There are about as many interpretations as there are people who work on quantum theory. But let's just take this as a kind of starting point, as a standard interpretation, and see if there's anything wrong with it. So the first postulate you read about is what I'll call the representational completeness of psi, the quantum state. And what it says is that the rays in Hilbert space correspond one-to-one with the physical states of the system. So I'm basically just saying the vectors in Hilbert space, but the global phase factor on those vectors is not significant, right? So if I have some overall phase sitting outside of my Hilbert space vector written in Dirac notation, that's not physically significant. So the equivalence class of these guys is just the ray in Hilbert space, the direction. So that's quite standard. And then there's another postulate about measurement, which says that measurements are associated with Hermitian operators on the Hilbert space. And if that Hermitian operator has certain spectral projections, so what I mean by that is I can always write the Hermitian operator, can everyone see this board here? Yeah. As sum over k, ak, times some projectors, pk, where each one of these pk's is a sum over all the eigenstates of A associated with the value AK. That's blocked? Okay. I'll push the... Yep. Front. Let me see. There. So these are just the eigenstates of A with eigenvalue AK. And J is just a degeneracy index. So that means that these projectors aren't necessarily projectors onto a single state. There could be many states like this, in which case the projector has a rank which is more than one. So all I'm saying here is suppose you have a Hermitian operator whose spectral projectors, these PKs, whose spectral projectors are denoted PK, and you do the measurement associated with that Hermitian operator. Then what the standard postulates tell you is that the probability of getting outcome k is just the expectation value of pk for the state psi that you've prepared. And more than that, it says that the probabilities that this specifies, so these are probabilities, if I sum over k, I get 1. The probabilities are objective. So there's real indeterminism in the theory according to the textbook way of presenting it. And what that means is that there should be nothing in the world that determines what the outcome is. So if you look at the entire state of the universe in the past of that measurement, nothing in the world fixes that outcome. It really is objectively undetermined. Okay, and then there's two postulates involving the evolution of these systems. So if you have a system that's isolated from all other systems, so it's not interacting with them, then it evolves unitarily. So the state in Dirac notation just gets mapped to some unitary operator acting on that state. And that unitary operator can always be written as the exponentiation of some Hermitian operator, which is the Hamiltonian, if it's evolving over some period of time t. And then the important thing to note about this evolution is, first of all, it's deterministic. For every initial state, there's a fixed final state, and vice versa. And secondly, it's continuous. If I take the limit of a very small time interval, the unitary is approximated by identity. And then finally, there's this postulate involving how systems evolve during measurement. So again, if you do a measurement associated with a Hermitian operator A that has spectral projectors PK, and you get the outcome K, Then the formalism says that the physical state of the system should change now discontinuously from whatever it was ahead of time, call it psi, to psi sub k, which is just the projection of psi into the eigenspace associated with the kth eigenvalue. So pk is just projection onto that eigenspace, normalized, so that at the end you still have a normalized quantum state. And that's basically it for the textbook postulates. And so now the question is, what's wrong with these? So a lot of people have found reason to complain about these. But rather than just tell you what people have been unhappy with, I want you to tell me what's wrong with these. So yes. Unclear what a measurement is. Do you want to say more about that?
People try to explain what's measurement, but I'm not sure if they have the process.
So one thing you could say is that a measurement is not really, most people would say, any kind of special type of interaction. It's just another interaction. So a measurement device is just another physical system. It's made out of atoms like everything else. It interacts with the system in a normal way. And so why is it that we need to make reference to measurements in these postulates? Couldn't we just talk about how physical systems evolve and what happens under interaction and deduce what happens under a measurement from those postulates rather than having this term measurement appear in the postulates themselves? Good? Yes? That's the problem. Max?
So it's not a physical thing to say that it has to be a Hermitian operator. That's a very mathematical definition. It doesn't really come from a physical intuition.
So are you saying that, as I showed earlier, the analog of special relativity, saying that a measurement is associated with a Hermitian operator is a bit like giving you the Lorentz transformations without really telling you where they come from. So ultimately, you prefer some sort of postulates from which you could derive that the measurements have to be associated with Hermitian operators rather than just stipulating that. Yes? And what's wrong with that?
Why wouldn't the evolution of a system?
So you're saying if the evolution of a system considered as isolated is continuous, then why should it be discontinuous under measurement? Well, somebody could say, it's whether you're evolving in an isolated way or whether you're undergoing a measurement, those are different ways of evolving. So why shouldn't one be discontinuous and the other continuous? So you could say there's sort of a lack of parsimony among these axioms, that it's odd that one of them specifies a continuous evolution, the other specifies a discontinuous evolution. That's certainly true. I think you can say something further, but before my volunteering that information, I'll give you guys a chance to complain about it. Yeah?
Yeah, well, if you think about the universe as an isolated system, then it should have continuous and unitary evolution, but we are stipulating that it should have discontinuities. So it's like the reasons.
Yeah. exactly. Let me say it this way, just rephrase what you said, that if you think, again, of the measurement device as a physical system made up of atoms and so forth, and you think of the system coupling to the measurement device as that composite, as an isolated system, then the whole thing is going to evolve according to this postulate, deterministically, continuously. And then this tells you that if you consider the measurement as an external intervention, the system is going to evolve discontinuously. And that seems like a contradiction. Seems like an inconsistency. Yes? other complaints.
I suppose the one that's been along is probably sorry, objective.
This one here,
yeah.
That indeterminism is objective. And what's wrong with that?
Counterintuitive.
From the perspective of a classical world, the classical theory, we haven't seen anything like that before. True. Of course, somebody could say, well, that's what, you know, scientific revolutions are about, introducing, you know, new things. But I think you could say, you know, that the less innovation a theory invokes, the better. So if you could get it closer to classical mechanics, perhaps that would be nicer. So you could hope that this indeterminism here was not objective, but just subjective. So it could be that we can't predict the outcomes of measurements, but the reason we can't predict them is not because there's nothing in the world that fixes what the outcome will be, but just that we don't have sufficient knowledge of the degrees of freedom in the past to predict that outcome. But there is something in the world that does predict it. We just don't have access to it. So you could have hoped that this indeterminism wouldn't be objective. I suppose a criticism, you could turn that into a criticism in the sense that you might say, well, all we really have warrant for, based on the experimental data, is say that there's some kind of indeterminism, but maybe it's too soon to say that indeterminism is necessarily objective as opposed to subjective. Does anybody see another problem with the indeterminism besides it being counterintuitive? Yep.
I mean, I kind of see it as a lack of a theory as opposed to an explanation. You just kind of figure out how often something happens, but it doesn't really, you have no mechanism for how it could choose one outcome from another. So it's basically a magic interaction where you just get something and you don't know why.
So you hope for more. You hope to be able to have a theory that can predict precisely what outcome would occur, as opposed to having some sort of...
At least in principle, even if you couldn't do it in practice.
Yep. Other complaints about standard postulates? So there's an argument that's made regarding determinism that's very similar to what we pointed out about the discontinuity. So just as we said before, if you think of measurement as a measurement device as another physical system, measurement is just another kind of physical interaction, then when you look at the composite of system and apparatus, they seem to be isolated, and so this postulate would tell us that they evolve deterministically. And yet this postulate here says if you consider the measurement as an external intervention, then the state of the system should evolve indeterministically. And just as, you know, the statement that the pair should evolve continuously seemed to be at odds with the claim that the system evolved discontinuously, you could say, well, that the assumption that they evolve deterministically seems to be at odds with the claim here that the system evolved indeterministically. Good. Okay.
So
yes.
The question I have. This way of kind of pointing to the picture where the deterministic behavior is more, I mean, makes more sense if you think about the system as a whole.
Yes.
Could it be that the third postulate about unitary evolution doesn't make sense actually?
Indeed, yeah. You could say that there's this apparent inconsistency among the postulates, but it's not necessarily the case that these are the postulates that are wrong. It could be that this is the postulate that's wrong. Yeah, and we're going to talk about that option. That's a viable option. Okay, so if nobody has any further complaints, I'll move on. Last chance to complain about standard quantum mechanics. Well, actually, no, that's not true. The whole course you have a chance to complain about it. Okay, so let me reiterate some of the problems that we just discussed. So the first problem, which you guys pointed out, was that the term measurement in those postulates is not ultimately defined in terms of these more primitive sorts of notions, such as the physical states of systems. You might have, or the kinds of evolutions those systems undergo. You might have hoped that you'd have a definition in the postulates of what a measurement was. How do you know whether a given interaction among systems counts as a measurement or not? How do you know whether to apply the postulates that refer to measurements? And so there's two general strategies for what to do about this generic problem. The first strategy, which I'll call the realist strategy, is to try to eliminate the notion of measurement from the postulates and describe everything in terms of physical states and their evolutions. So the idea here is, rather than have postulates that refer to what happens during a measurement, just say, here's what happens for any system in a particular physical state evolving in a certain way. And if that has certain consequences for measurements, then so be it. But we're not going to put that in the postulates. We're going to derive that from some postulates about how physical states evolve. The second general strategy is to go the other route and eliminate the notion of the physical state of a system as a primitive concept, and instead describe everything in terms of operational concepts. So by operational concepts here, I mean things like measurements, preparations, things you do in the lab. So the general strategies here falls into the philosophical tradition of empiricism. So there's this very long debate in the philosophy of science, you could say a lot about, but one way of drawing a dichotomy among positions is to say that there's a certain school that thinks that explanations should bottom out with abstract concepts, like, say, particles moving in the void, and that things like, detectors firing are ultimately explained in terms of, the motions of the atoms in those detectors. And it's more appropriate to explain how detectors work in terms of, how their constituent atoms are behaving. That's the realist strategy. But there's another school of thought that says, look, our epistemic access, or, what we can say about the world is entirely limited to, what we observe. So we should reduce our explanations to claims about, what we've observed. Things like, what do you see in the lab? Or, the logical positivists at the turn of the 20th century were arguing that everything should be reduced to statements about phenomena. And so something like, an atom moving through the void, they would say, ultimately is just a very fancy way of summarizing, what you would see if you set up a certain experiment that involved that atom, and it all comes down to your observations. So Ernst Mach, for example, was a proponent of this approach, and he said, it's not the business of science to explain, for instance, why the planets move as they do. It's the business of science to explain precisely and efficiently how they move and what we should observe, and that's it, nothing more. So in this kind of strategy, you would say, well, it's, any talk about the physical state of a system really should just be reduced to a statement about what we're going to see in the lab. And so we should try to eliminate those as much as possible from the postulates and talk only in terms of measurements and preparations and macroscopic everyday concepts. So first of all, let me point out that both of these positions have prominent proponents for them. So John Bell, for example, you might have heard of him, was a realist. So here's a quote from one of his papers. It would seem that the theory, he's talking about quantum theory, is exclusively concerned about the results of measurements and has nothing to say about anything else. But what exactly qualifies some physical system to play the role of measurer? So this is exactly the sort of problem we've been talking about. It would be nice, according to Bell, to have some criterion for what's a measurement. But on the other hand, Asher Perez, who was an operationalist, says, when he's talking about what quantum theory is ultimately about, in a strict sense, it's a set of rules allowing the computational probabilities for the outcomes of tests which follow specified preparations. And that's it. That's all that quantum theory is, and that's all we should hope for in a scientific theory. Okay, so I'm going to talk more about the operational route next time and throughout the week. For the rest of this lecture, I'm going to talk about the realist strategy. So bear that in mind. So for the rest of this lecture, we're going to put ourselves in this camp and ask what can be done to make sense of quantum theory. All right, so let's go over the inconsistencies we found. So I see the best complaint that can be made about those postulates that we set down is a complaint about their inconsistencies among them. So here I'll just repeat the inconsistencies we found, and then I'll talk about one more inconsistency. So if you decide to treat your measurement device as an external intervention rather than assign it a Hilbert space, think about it as a dynamical system. Here we're thinking about it as a dynamical system. Here we're considering it as an external intervention. And let me first say that, I mean, this is not something that's, you know, unique to quantum theory. We can do this in classical theories as well. So if I have a problem that I want to solve, for example, I want to solve the dynamics of a ball bouncing off of a wall. So I have, I assign a position to the ball. I write down equations of motion for the ball. Now I have two choices about how I want to model the wall. One choice would be model it as maybe an infinitely high potential, which just appears in the equations of motion for the position of the ball. And I can do that, and it'll tell me that the ball is just going to reflect back. Or if I want, I could say, oh, the wall is another dynamical system. It has a certain mass. It has a position. Now I'm going to solve the equations of motion for the ball and the wall. And what you'll find if you do that is that because the wall, which is connected to the Earth, is much, much more massive than the ball, then the back reaction that the wall feels is insignificant. And ultimately, the relative position of the ball to the wall falls exactly in that second model, what I saw in the first model. So it's really these two options are a choice that the physicist makes for convenience. You can treat the wall as an external potential if you want. You can treat it as a dynamical degree of freedom if you want. As long as it's, you know, big enough to simulate an external potential well, it's a good approximation, you can do that. It's up to you. So similarly here, you'd think that whether you choose to model the measurement as a complicated dynamical system, which is coupling to your system of interest, or whether you model it as some sort of external intervention to which you're not going to assign a Hilbert space, shouldn't make a difference. It should be up to you which of those two models you choose. You shouldn't get different predictions depending on what you choose. But unfortunately, what the orthodox postulates suggest is that you do get different predictions, because if you take your measurement to be some kind of external intervention, then the system, according to the postulates, should evolve in a way that's indeterministic and discontinuous under a measurement. That's what we saw in the second and fourth postulates, that systems undergoing measurements will obey a collapse postulate, which is objectively indeterministic and discontinuous. Whereas if we treat the measurement device as just another dynamical system, which is coupling to the system of interest, and the whole thing is isolated and evolving unitarily, then the pair of them are evolving deterministically and continuously, and therefore the system is also evolving deterministically and continuously. So you have this inconsistency in these two ways of modeling the same situation. There's a second inconsistency having to do with whether the system and the apparatus get determinate properties or not. So think of that as just whether they get well-defined properties or not. So let me say a little bit more about that, because that's sort of the one remaining problem, prominent problem with the orthodox postulates that people have worried about. And I should say that this second problem sometimes goes by the name of the quantum measurement problem. Now, as with many things, this title is sometimes used to just mean the generic problem of the fact that measurement is not well defined within those postulates. But in the foundations literature, it also has a more technical sense of this very specific inconsistency between the properties being determinate or not. And that's the sense in which I'm going to use the term. So consider the following simple experiment. It's just a Stern-Gerlach experiment. So what you've got here is an oven emitting silver atoms that have a particular spin. Maybe there's some preparation of the atoms inside this box. So this box will be our preparation procedure. And so imagine that, you know, they come out in some well-confined wave packet, and then they get passed through the Stern-Gerlach magnets. So there's an inhomogeneous magnetic field here, and it couples to the magnetic moment of these spins, and it causes them to deflect along, you know, one of two directions, depending on whether the spin is plus h bar over 2 or minus h bar over 2. And what you ultimately get is, if you put a photographic plate here, for example, is a detection either here or here for every atom. Okay, so how do we model that if we treat the measurement device as an external intervention? So suppose, first of all, that over here we do some processing so that we prepare this kind of quantum state for the spins. So A and B are just some complex amplitudes. Up and down represent the eigenstates of spin along the z-axis, which is the vertical axis in this diagram. So if A were 1 and B were 0, we'd be preparing spins that were necessarily up along the z-axis, and we'd expect them all to come out up here. And if we prepared it with B equal to 1 and A equal to 0, we'd expect them all to come down here. But if we prepare this superposition, then what the postulates tell us is that with probability mod A squared, we should find a detection at this spot. And if we manage to do that measurement in a way that leaves the spin undisturbed afterwards, then the spin collapses to the Z spin up state. And similarly, if we have this outcome here, spin down with probability B squared, and if the spin survives, then it's projected into the down state. So that's just the standard approach. But what if we now instead treat this measurement device as a dynamical degree of freedom, assign it a Hilbert space, couple it to the system, evolve? What do we get? Well, here it's the argument that I'm going to make doesn't commit me to telling you exactly what these degrees of freedom of the apparatus are. So all I really need here is that first postulate, which said, you know, the physical states of a system are associated one-to-one with rays in Hilbert space. So although it might be difficult for me to come up with a model of the measurement device, you know, it's got some complicated physics, I know by virtue of the first postulate that there is some ray in the Hilbert space of that system which describes its physical state. So I'm just going to call that vector the ready vector. So this describes the apparatus in the state that we would describe as, you know, ready to measure. You know, it's all primed to go. And the first postulate guarantees that there is such a state. And then the second thing I'm going to do is assume that the apparatus actually works properly. So I know that when I couple the apparatus to the system, they're going to evolve together by some unitary. That's what the third postulate told me. And furthermore, if the system was Z spin up to begin with, then I know that the apparatus should go into a state which registers the up outcome. So maybe there's some, for example, in this case, you know, some photographic film that's going to be developed, and I'm going to be able to distinguish up from down. Well, it had better be that when the Z spin of the system is up, then it's going to evolve into some state that indicates up. So again, I don't necessarily know exactly how to describe the state, but postulate one guarantees that there is some vector in Hilbert space that will describe that physical state. So let's just call it up. So similarly, over here, if I start with the Z spin down and the apparatus is ready, then under this interaction, this unitary, it has to be that the apparatus evolves to some state that indicates the outcome down. Okay, so is everybody happy with that so far? Yes? So we're going to drive a contradiction soon, so. okay, now the key thing about the evolution here being unitary is that a unitary operator is a linear operator, which means that if I act a unitary operator on a linear combination of two vectors, psi and phi, with complex coefficients a and b, then it just gives me this. So the one way to say it in words is that the evolute, the unitary evolute of the coherent superposition of psi and phi is the same coherent superposition of the unitary evolute of psi and the unitary evolute of phi. That's the assumption of linearity. And so if we apply that assumption, what we find is that if I start with a state that is A up plus B down, rather than up or down alone, so I start the system in this state, and again, I have my apparatus in that same ready state, and I apply the unitary coupling to the system and apparatus, then I can distribute, well, first of all, I can rewrite this guy as just a sum of those two terms, so I'm just distributing the ready state over here, and then by the linearity of U, I can apply it to each term in this superposition, and then I just use these two equations here to find that I get A up tensor apparatus indicates up plus B spin down tensor apparatus indicates down. And so that's what the theory tells me should happen if I start with this kind of state. And now the problem is that this is not what we would traditionally think of as a state wherein the apparatus indicates up or indicates down, or the spin is up or the spin is down. Why is that? Well, usually what we do is, let's say we're interested in knowing whether the spin along the z-axis is well-defined for a particular quantum state. So what we usually say is that it's only well-defined if that quantum state is an eigenstate of spin along the z-axis. So you could say, is this guy here that I wrote down an eigenstate of the z-spin operator? Well, this is a state on system tensor apparatus. So I'm going to have to ask whether it's an eigenstate of spin along the z-axis for the system tensor identity for the apparatus. So I don't care about the apparatus. And so if I just act this on the state, then SZ distributes, and the up state has eigenvalue plus 1, the down state has eigenvalue minus 1. So that's that. But that is not proportional to some scalar times A up plus B down, because the signs between these two terms are different. So this state is not an eigenstate of SZ. So traditionally we'd say, right, SZ is not well defined for that state. Anything that's, if it's not an eigenstate of position, then position is not well defined. If it's not an eigenstate of S sub Z, then spin along the Z-axis is not well defined. So similarly, if I go back, we could ask about the apparatus and say, does it have well-defined properties such as, pointing up or pointing down? And if we looked at a Hermitian operator that picked out this property we're interested in, say plus 1 times the projector onto the apparatus indicating up and minus 1 times the projector onto the apparatus indicating down, we would again find that this superposition here, this entangled state, is not an eigenstate of that guy. And so we're not warranted in saying that those properties are well-defined. Good. So that's basically the last problem. Did I? Yes. Go ahead.
You have your system treated as a composite system.
Yes.
And then you're making projections on that part of the system. Would it make sense that the only physical operators you could have are ones that act on the whole system? So you would have to have some composite operator that acts on both spin and apparatus.
You do, in the sense that if you're not...
So then you would have to have an operator that acts as a, well, up on the particle and up on the apparatus and down on the particle, down on the apparatus.
So you could certainly look at that, but you wouldn't get a different result if you did. So if instead of looking at S sub Z, I looked at something that had, say, up for the spin tensor, up for the apparatus, plus some other eigenvalue, down for the spin tensor, down for the apparatus, right? So the key is that this thing had better have different eigenvalues for these two guys in order to distinguish them, right? If there's a degeneracy here, then this doesn't distinguish those two properties. So suppose I did that, had a different operator. It would still be the case that this entangled state is not an eigenstate of that operator I described. So I cannot say that the spin has the property of, or the system, the particle does not have the property of Z spin. The apparatus does not have the property of indicating up or down. But furthermore, the composite of system and apparatus does not have the property of being spin up and indicating up, or the property of being spin down and indicating down. So even if you think of them as a pair, you still have this problem. So the problem is that people say that once you get to these funny entangled states, it's no longer appropriate to say that you have the properties that we know to be true, that it's really the apparatus is really indicating up or indicating down. It seems like it's sort of somehow Schrodinger's words, where it's sort of mixed or smeared out between the two options. And one way to think about this is that you might have been comfortable having some smearing out between two options down here at the microscopic level when we're talking about particles. But this argument shows that you can even get that smearing out between these two classical options at the macroscopic level, pointers pointing in one direction or another. Yes? Can you repeat the question?
Can we do something for those two up and down phase on the second?
Do you mean this term and this term?
Yeah, to interfere with each other.
I see. So you're saying, could we do, or maybe this term and this term, could we do an interference experiment that would show that we really have this state at the end?
Yeah.
In principle, you can imagine such an experiment. But if this system is large enough, it's infeasible in practice. Mm-hmm. And one of the main tricks, there's a lot of effort these days in trying to generate so-called macroscopic superpositions, where you try to have this smearing out effect between two physically distinct states of very large systems. For precisely these sorts of reasons, people are interested in trying to figure out whether they see a breakdown of quantum mechanics when the larger that system gets. But the real challenge is that the bigger the system becomes, the more decoherence becomes a problem, that it's very hard to isolate a large system from its environment. And if the environment couples to it, it will sort of become entangled with the other systems, and you won't see the interference you're looking for. Well, I'll come back to that in a moment. So one other thing I want to say here is that when Schrodinger described this problem, he also had this more dramatic story that went along with it. So not only can you imagine having a scenario wherein an apparatus fails to have well-defined properties, you could also put a living being in there if you want. So he didn't use the Stern-Gerlach experiment, but you could. You could say, set up your Stern-Gerlach experiment, and then trigger the release of the hammer on whether you get an up outcome or not. And the hammer strikes the vial of poison and kills the cat if the spin was up, and the cat stays alive if the spin was down. And the point is just that now, at the end of the day, if you really believe the orthodox postulates, then it's not the case that the cat has any well-defined property of being alive or dead. So the final state would be up, tensor, apparatus indicates up, tensor, cat alive, plus down, tensor indicates down, tensor, cat dead. So that's just to make the story more dramatic. All right, and now the question is, what can we do about this problem? So suppose you're a realist, you want to interpret quantum mechanics in a realist way. Can you get around, are there ways of getting around these problems we've talked about? In particular, this quantum measurement problem. And I have some slides on what I call false starts to solving the measurement problem. So there's some real viable options, but there's also some ideas that seem very compelling at first, but ultimately don't work. And so I'd like you to tell me ideas about how to solve these problems. And maybe you'll get some of the ideas that are viable as far as we know. And maybe you'll fall into my trap and give us one of the false starts. And that's OK. But let me start by asking you how you might try to solve this problem. So now I'm saying that, you know, the challenge is, you know, you get Heis points if you manage to somehow figure out how to solve this problem while maintaining the orthodox postulates. But you might have to abandon some of the orthodox postulates.
Probably
yes.
The evolution operator is not unitary.
Evolution is not unitary. Okay. Now the trick there is, suppose you say evolution is not unitary, then I can come back with, well, we've done some very precise experiments on microscopic systems testing deviations from unitarity, and we've never seen it. So if evolution is not unitary, why have we never seen it break down in the systems we've measured?
Even worse than that, unitarity is needed for this argument, only linearity. And saying you have a nonlinear operator in Hilbert space is way more violent than a non-unitary.
That's true, yeah. You couldn't just say it's not unitary but still linear. You'd have to say it's nonlinear evolution to get around this problem here. That's true. Other ideas?
I guess there's the standard claim that, or well, maybe it's an old one, that the Hilbert space approach just doesn't apply to macroscopic systems. There's a cut somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe the point where unitarity breaks down is at some level of macroscopicness. Mm-hmm. And so measurement apparatus just evolved differently from microscopic systems. And then we would need to provide some prescription for where the cut occurs and some dynamics for the stuff on either side, on the other side of the cut.
Well, it doesn't have to be a cut. I mean, you tested it microscopically. So it could be that it's somehow relevant to the length scale. And if you increase the scale of your system, then in some even linear fashion, you could have some non-unitarity effects.
Let me think about that. So you're saying it might be different dynamics depending on the length
and the
scale.
And the limit of very small systems would have unitarity.
Yes.
But somehow non-unitary effects appearing on bigger length scales. That will be relevant for the resolution of black hole formation loss parameters, where you have a really big length scale there.
It's an interesting proposal. I wonder whether you might be able to say that the realm in which we've tested quantum theory, although we sometimes describe it as microscopic, should not be considered a realm of small length scales. So I'm thinking, for example, there's a paper by Wheeler where he talks about interference between photons going two ways around a galaxy. And so suppose it were true that we can detect quantum interference for a photon going, you know, two paths around some large mass object, then you can say, well, that's about as large a length scale as you could hope to test quantum theory on, and it seems to be corroborated. So my hesitation is that I'm not sure whether we really see quantum interference as opposed to just classical interference in that scenario. But I do wonder whether it's better to say that, you know, we've tested quantum theory for systems that are very simple in the sense that they don't have many, considered as a composite, they have very few parts. And we haven't, you know, the place where quantum mechanics could break down is at highly composite systems with more parts. But it's an interesting question. I'll think about it. Yes?
We could get rid of the indeterminacy postulate by saying that there is something in the world. Don't want to say limit of reality, but basically it's sort of something that is down there that we can't just access by preparations.
Mm.
And that ultimately determines whether the cat is alive or dead.
Right. So if you did that, not only would you have to change postulate 2 and replace it with something that says that the indeterminism is purely subjective, you'd also have to change postulate 1. Because when you say there's something deeper that's not specified by the quantum state, you're then rejecting the idea that the possible physical states of the system are associated one-to-one with the vectors in Hilbert space. That is indeed another option. Sometimes goes by the name of hidden variable theories.
So I mean, you have some external state which you, so it's in up or down,
yep.
But then we need to get that information out. And when we get that information out, maybe we could somehow do some sort of, I don't know, I guess that would just be another unitary transformation. I don't know. It that would seem to be the way you'd have to fix it. Because that's the problem. When you actually look at it, you have, you get one or the other. So there has to be something about getting how you remove the result and, you know, put it on paper, that however that measurement occurs, that I don't know, that would be where I would look.
So are you saying that there should be some role for the observer to play as opposed to just a measurement device, that an observer is somehow critical?
Well, I mean, I guess a measurement device is an observer. I guess if you count ready, or sorry, up or down as the measurement device's state.
Yeah.
Then okay. I mean, then in some sense, if you then measure up or down on that state, you're going to get it's just like measuring with probability A squared or B squared. So.
Well, one thing, I'm not exactly sure what you're suggesting, but let me say something which may be connected to what you're thinking. So von Neumann, in his famous textbook, pointed out the following fact, which is that if you imagine a second apparatus, a larger apparatus on the outside, which kind of looks in and does a measurement on your first apparatus. Say your first apparatus has some pointer. Your second apparatus is going to look at that pointer. Maybe it's got a video camera. So it's going to do a measurement of that to see whether your apparatus came out up or down. So if you treat that, the first apparatus internally, assign it a number space, treat the second apparatus externally, and use the collapse postulates for the first apparatus, you'll find at the end of the day, this guy here, this state now collapses to either this term with probability A squared or this term with probability B squared. So von Neumann said, that's good because we have consistency. It doesn't matter where we put the cut between what's treated internally and externally. We always get the same predictions. But what the realist points out, the skeptic of the orthodox interpretation, is that it's true that no matter where you put the cut, you get the same predictions. But ultimately, one should be able to treat everything internally. And then there's no cut, and we get these sort of funny superpositions where things are smeared out, and we can't interpret it as one or the other. Yes?
Then one thing is, if you think about, we would know whether it's up or down if
yeah.
we really measured it. We're somehow an external observer.
Yeah.
We have to have a readout saying this is up or down.
Yes.
So we're somehow treating the whole process of knowing whether it's up or down externally, the way we think about it. So there is probably some problem with us classically thinking about the quantum result. So it's possible that it doesn't have to collapse, but as it really could be a smeared out version of everything.
So
if you have
yeah.
some kind of succession of
yeah.
measurement of observers observing the observers,
yes,
then maybe in some limit you could get out internally.
Okay, so I think what you're moving towards is, imagine you have an observer looking in, but now treat that observer as a dynamical system with a ray and Hilbert space describing it. So then, you know, each of these guys, the observer will come to observe up, here he'll come to observe down, and here the observer will become smeared out between these two options. And then you say, well, what would such an observer observe? What would it be like to be an observer in this kind of quantum state? Now, some realists would say, well, he would sort of be, of course, one having some sort of funny experience, which we don't experience. But Everett famously suggested that maybe what it corresponds to is having sort of two versions of yourself in different universes that don't see one another. And subjectively, one version of yourself sees the apparatus indicating up, and the other version of yourself sees the apparatus indicating down. In reality, that's just an illusion. You know, both things are happening in this smeared out way. But to you, who lives inside the universe and who's entangled, subjectively, it appears like one or the other. So it sounds to me like you're suggesting something similar to the many worlds interpretation that Everett suggested.
It wasn't my aim.
It wasn't your aim, okay. All right, well, because we're out of time, let me move forward to just summarize those views. So actually, I think I'm going to skip the false starts because, well, you know, if you don't fall into these traps, then you don't need to worry about it. And just talk about the various options. So first is, I think we've heard almost all these options. The first is deny the universality of the quantum dynamics. So one option for that is to say that there's some cut that distinguishes classical systems from quantum systems. We have to have a dynamics for the classical systems, the dynamics for the quantum systems, and a criterion for what counts as a classical system. Overall, I would say people have not had much success with these sorts of approaches. Nobody's come up with a good criterion for what distinguishes classical and quantum, or a way of coupling the dynamics on either side of the cut. In this category falls a number of suggestions that involve the observers as being somehow special. So some people would say what's on the other side of the cut are sentient observers, and they somehow undergo a different dynamics and manage to collapse wave functions. But as I say, there's I wouldn't say that there are any really fully fleshed out models of this sort. On the other hand, there's a different set of models called collapse models, which are more viable. And they basically say that there's no cut. Every system evolves in exactly the same way. But that evolution is not, strictly speaking, unitary. So this is like the suggestion you made. The trick is that the deviation from unitarity is very small. And for a single system, you would not see it. So one such example would be things get localized every once in a while. But for an individual particle, you only get localized once every billion years. And so if you're doing a tabletop interference experiment, you wouldn't expect to see any deviation from unitarity. But if you have 10 to the 23 particles in an apparatus, and it's sufficient to localize just one of them to localize all of them, and as I'll show you eventually, that's true in these collapse models, then the fact that every particle only gets localized every billion years doesn't matter because you have 10 to the 23 particles. So one of them is going to be localized, and the whole thing gets localized extremely quickly. So these sorts of models basically achieve a different kind of dynamics for highly composite systems compared to microscopic systems. And we'll talk about those in the last week. Another option is to deny that postulate number one, the representational completeness of the quantum state. And so that's basically the hidden variable option. So here you could hope, for example, to salvage determinism if you wanted and make the indeterminism in quantum theory merely subjective. Others have suggested that this fails even though we still have indeterminism in order to solve things like the Schrodinger cat problem. And there's two breeds of hidden variable models, one wherein the quantum state is itself part of the description of reality, and another set of models where the quantum state is closer to a description of the probability distribution over the possible states of reality. So this guy here, there's an example of it, a well-known example, which is the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation of quantum mechanics. And we'll talk about that in the last week. And I'll say a little bit about the possibilities for these second sorts of models probably next week. Finally, you could go Everett's route and say the idea that there's a unique outcome and the apparatus really indicates up or really indicates down, that's just an illusion that, in fact, everything is smeared out among all possibilities. All we have is unitary evolution. It's just that from the subjective perspective of observers living inside the universe who are in a particular branch of that wave function, they just see certain options. So that's sometimes called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. And there's a lot of debate about whether it makes sense. And it has some technical problems, which we'll also talk about in the last week. Another option, which I'm not really going to have a chance to talk about in this course, is a bit different. It says maybe there's some aspect of classical logic or classical probability theory that breaks down. And so what quantum mechanics really forces us to do is, so what is classical logic? Classical logic is the set of rules for how to reason correctly about the world, how to make inferences. Maybe those rules are mistaken. The rules we've used up to now are not the right set of rules for correct reasoning. Probability theory can be thought of as the set of rules for reasoning in the presence of limited information or in the presence of uncertainty. And again, you might say that what we previously thought those correct rules were was wrong and that we have to update them. And so there's a couple of strategies that take that to be the innovation of quantum theory. And then finally, maybe if you're a realist, you could still salvage your realism by doing something else. You might be able to identify some other part of the framework, the realist framework, which could be abandoned besides one of these other options, and develop a realist interpretation of a different flavor from all of these. So that's a bit of a preview of where we're ultimately going to get to in the course, and let me stop there. And see you tomorrow.